And we're holding on page Yud in Sota, about the middle of the page, a few lines from the end of Os Chafav. We learned last time that there were five, we said there were five people that Nivru Mein Dugma Shomaila. They were created with something about them that's a semblance of Shomaila. So Rashi says that meant just that they're unique, they're like superhuman among other people in this particular characteristic. Some of Farshim explained that meant that particularly it meant that they're created with that characteristic being like automation. One of them was Shimshin's strength, which is why we brought it in over here. And then the Gemara had brought a bunch more, and it said each one of them ended up getting punished through that particular thing. So Shimshin's strength, when his strength left him, is when the Plishtim got him. The same way Shol's special thing was his neck, and in the end, when he was killed in the battle with the Plishtim over there, the sword pierced his neck, and so forth. So now, the last one we mentioned was that Ossa, one of the kings of Yehuda, his special thing was his feet. He had tremendous superhuman strength in his feet. Ben Yehoyada says, in particular, that would mean, for example, he would have been able to carry heavy burdens on them. But now, at the end of his life, 2 years before he passed away, the Pasuk says he got a disease called podagra, a gout in English, which is very, very painful. And eventually, the Pasuk says he passed away from it. So, Dorash Rava, so in this connection, Rava Darshan's, it's named Ma Nenesh HaMelech Ossa. Why was King Ossa punished? So let's recap a little bit with a story. The story is in Sefer Melachim, and there's more details about it in Divrei Yomim. During, Ossa was the third king after the kingdoms had been split. He's the third king of Malchus Yehuda only. And then his opposite number in Malchus Yisrael, for much of his reign, was a fellow named Baasha. At one point, this Baasha goes and starts building fortifications near Yerushalayim to prevent people from getting in and out of the kingdom of Yehuda. As it is, we learned before that we learned at the end of Gittin that the kings of Yisrael had put up guards to prevent people being Erlo Lerego, but other than that, I guess the Pashtus, you could travel freely from one to the other. Now this Baasha is trying to blockade Malchus Yisrael altogether. So, Malchus, the king of Malchus Yisrael, is trying to blockade Malchus Yehuda with his fortifications. So, Ossa gets nervous. He sends a message to Ben-Hadad, the king of Aram, asking him to send him a huge bribe of gold and silver to ask him to help him out. And Ben-Hadad goes and attacks the northern parts of Eretz Yisrael, which are near Aram. That's part of Baasha's kingdom, so he has to deal with that threat. So he goes and then breaks off his building project and goes to deal with that threat. Meanwhile, so now, the Pasuk says now, the Gemara is going to quote the Pasuk of what Ossa did at that point, that how he needed manpower to dismantle those fortifications. Then the Pasuk goes on to say, actually, now the next part is not actually here in the Gemara, but it's worth mentioning anyway, especially because we quoted a Pasuk in that connection before, afterwards in Divrei Yom. So in Melachim, it just stops right there, that he had people take apart the fortifications. The Gemara is going to quote a Pasuk and rebuild other cities in Eretz Yehuda with them. In Divrei Yom, it goes on to give more detail that a Navi comes to Ossa and he says you made a mistake by doing that. You should have trusted more in Hashem rather than going and sending bribes to the king of Aram, and Hashem would have helped that you would have not only conquered the king, not only you would have defeated the kingdom of Israel, you would have even defeated Aram. In fact, Rashi mentions in Melachim that in fact the original plan was that the kingdoms should be split for only 36 years, and this was the end of the 36 years. Had Ossa had more bitachon, then you would have had once again one united kingdom of all 12 Shvatim. Anyway, the Pasuk mentions The Pasuk says that Ossa got angry at the Navi for that and put him in jail. The Pasuk also mentions Vayirat, it's Ossa min ha'om, Ossa crushed some of the people. We quoted that when we learned. Maharsha says that Rashi had said there's no real proof. Where is there a proof in the Gemara that there was something supernaturally strong about Ossa's feet? Rashi says, I don't know where. Maharsha says, because of that Pasuk, Vayirat, it's Ossa min ha'om, implies that he was able to do something unique with his feet to them, that just stepping on them, in other words, would like crush them or something, showing that he had superhuman strength in his feet. Anyway, so Rava is saying, why was Ossa punished with this gout, with this podagra? Because he had the Talmid of Chachamim do royal work for him. Shenema, as the Pasuk says, Melech Ossa Yishmias Kol Yehuda, King Ossa gathered together all the people of Yehuda. Ein Noki, nobody is clean, meaning nobody is exempt. And the Pasuk goes on to say that he had them take apart all these fortifications that Baasha had built and use the wood and the stones and whatnot to rebuild some other cities in Eretz Yehuda. So my enoki, so therefore, my enoki, what's this word enoki? Nobody is in, nobody is exempt. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, afilo chosan mechedre, v'talam mechuposa, means he was even ordering the chasanim and the kalas to leave their chasana hall and come and help in this project. It actually points out by the chosan, it says, noki yilavese, he should be clean, he should be exempt from any military duty and any public works projects like that for an entire year after he gets married, but here also was overriding that and saying that everybody needs to come and help. Marshall explains, in other words, there are actually two different things over there. Hishmias kol Yehuda, the word kol means everybody including the chachamim. Enoki is a separate thing that in addition he was also drafting all the chasanim and kalas. Which now, therefore, so he's over on two things. He's not supposed to use Tamar Chachamim for such things, as important a project as it is. It's not worthy of causing the Tamar Chachamim to leave their Torah, to be busy with this work, especially it wasn't a matter of Pekuach Nefesh anymore. At this point, when Basha is dealing with the threat on his northern borders, then it's not such an immediate emergency that everybody has to take apart these fortifications. And then on top of that, also that he was over when the Pasuk says about a Chosin and Kala, Noki Yilavesa. Here it says, in Rav Shah says, not a Mechamas Mitzvah, and therefore, so therefore in the end, also was punished for that by getting this disease in his feet. Ion Yaakov points out that, in other words, here you have like this, midah keneged midah is like this, you have a moment shemamid adam al raglav, you have the expression that a person's wealth puts him on his feet. So here he forced the Tamar Chachamim to contribute their labor to a public works project like that. So now, Tamar Chachamim are the ones who use their feet to travel from place to place to learn Torah. Therefore, he was punished, and because of that, they're potter from contributing to the king's treasury with their labor or with their taxes or whatever. Therefore, he was punished in his feet. Getting back one little bit to Shimshon, Siv Vayered Shimshon Timnasa, a pasuk says that Shimshon went down to Timnah, which implies that the place is located in a valley. Meanwhile, we have the same place, on the face of it, the same place, mentioned in connection with the story of Yehuda and Tamar, where Tamar has been waiting, she expects she's going to marry Yehuda's third son, Shelah. Meanwhile, Yehuda is pushing off the matter, because as far as he knows, she's a Katlonis, he doesn't know why Aaron Onan died. So now they tell her that your father-in-law is going to Timnasa to shear his sheep, and then she pretended to be a Zoyna, and everything developed from there. But there it says that they tell her he's going up to Timnasa. So what is it? Is it you go downhill there or uphill? So the answer is, so the Gemara gives a few answers. Amar Rabbi Elazar, Shimshon shenisgana ba, the difference is that Shimshon was degraded by it, because that was, as we said, he married a plishti girl over there. Okay, we can talk about, as we talked about the last few days, that technically he was Megayer her. Still, you know, the Rambam points out, you know, we've been mentioning this point that he was Megayer the women that he was with. Nevertheless, though, the Pasuk never mentions that point, and the Rambam mentions, because after all, it turns out the Gedos was not really the Shem Shemayim. We see with this girl from Timnasa that afterwards, after Shimshon left, then she had no problem going and marrying a plishti goy, and mind you, she's a married woman too, even by the goyim such a thing is unacceptable, and she still had no problem with her father marrying her off to somebody else. Delilah was even worse in her own way, you know, so therefore the Pasuk doesn't make a point of mentioning that he was Megayer them, and therefore we can say that it was a degradation for him to do this in the first place. On the other hand, Yehuda was exalted in it. Through his going to Timnasa, he ended up meeting Tamar, and they had relations, and eventually Peretz and Zerach were born from that, and from Peretz comes Malchus Beis David and Mashiach, so therefore he was elevated by Yitzchak Bei Aliyah, so therefore by him it says the Lashon Oyla. And you think about it, in other words, the point is that there's a certain superficial similarity with both of them. Both of them are having relations where it seems to be improper, but Shimshon is doing it in a way that ended up causing his downfall, whereas by Yehuda, on the contrary, it caused him to go up.
This is more of a
Jirash. Right. So Marashah says, in other words, the Gemara could have said one of them is Bepashtus and the other one is for the Jirasha. But given that we don't really have a way of knowing which one would be the Pshat and which one is for the Jirash, so Rabbi Elazar is assuming both of them are for the Jirasha. Actually, Marashah points out an interesting point. You look at the psukim with Shimshon over there in Perek Yudalit of Shoftim, you find like this. It does start off by Yered Shimshon Timnasa. Then the pasuk continues by Yaal. He went up from there and he tells his parents and he says, I want to marry this girl. And they try to talk him out of it, and he says, no, ki hi yoshra ve'enai, and then the pasuk says they went down to Timna. So on the face of it, you would say that, yeah, Timna is in a valley, and therefore he's going down there, and then he's coming up, and then he's going down. Marsha says, based on the drosha over here, what it might be like this is, he goes down there, and we're saying that was the yirida for him, because it turned out to be a gnai. But then he comes up from there to go and consult with his parents, and they try to talk him out of it. That's an aliyah. That's at that point, they're trying to talk him out of doing this seemingly improper thing. And therefore, that can be called an aliyah. But now, though, in the end, they seem to have made their peace with it. And the pasuk says all of them went down there to arrange the wedding. So therefore, again, it uses the word yirida to imply that all three of them are now going down in their ruchniyistic level. So that's one answer. Rav Shmuel ben Nachmeni Omar. Rav Shmuel ben Nachmeni says the second answer. Very simple. Tarki Timna Sabu. There's two places called Timna. Chod b'yirida v'chod b'aliyah. One of them is uphill, one of them is downhill. Rapapa Omar, Rapapa says you don't have to say there's two different places. Chod Timnas Havoi, it's one place called Timnas, but it's on the slope of a mountain. Da'osi mehai gisa yirida, when you come from one direction, you're going downhill. Da'osi mehai gisa aliyah, when you're coming from the other direction, it's uphill. Wait. You're making a face like it seems so posh. Why didn't everybody give that answer? Hold that thought a second. Kigoin, first of all, the Gemara gives examples. Kigoin Vardinia, Ubei Bori, Veshuka, Daneresh, for example, you have these various cities in Babel that were located on slopes of hills. Now, there's a sicha where the Rebbe discusses that Rashi on the Pasuk only brings the point about the Yerida and the Aliyah respectively, about that it's on the slope of a hill, and you have to go uphill or downhill respectively to get there. Why does Rashi not bring either of the two? And then in B'Soich HaDvarim, the Rebbe also discusses, why does the Gemara have to bring examples? And the answer is like this, the Rebbe explains, I think it's in the Chelek Tes. You have like this. There's an advantage to building a city on top of a hill. It's very inconvenient in terms of you have to always climb uphill to get there. And in fact, some of these places, Dei Bori and Neresh, the Gemara elsewhere points out, Rav Huna Breder Rav Yeshua says about himself that I became prematurely old from going uphill and downhill to these towns all the time. So it's not necessarily the best thing to have a city on the top of a mountain, on the top of a hill. On the other hand, it's got its advantages. It's more defensible. Then you have the flip side of it is you might want to build a city on the bottom of a mountain. It's not as easily defensible, but it's more convenient to get to and from. To build it on the side of a hill, you have both of the disadvantages and none of the advantages. Why would anyone do that? So therefore, so Rashi considers it. Nevertheless, Rashi is pointing out that that's how it was over here, that that's the most straightforward way, according to Pshat of the Pesukim, and then the Gemara has to bring no less than three examples to show. Nevertheless, you might say that it's not logical to build a city that way. Nevertheless, it's so you can see in Babel alone, there were three cities that were built like that on the slope of a hill. The Rebbe, by the way, learns from that according to that, it comes out there's a hurrah and avodah, that in other words, in life, it's always like timnos. You're either going up or down. There's no standing still in avodah. You're either going upward or you're slipping downward. And that's the message of this. Anyway, so three different answers why it says Yerida and Aliyah respectively. Okay. Next. So now at this point the Gemara is pretty much finished with the story of Shimshon, and now having mentioned the story of Yehuda and Tamar, now the Gemara is going to take a little while dealing with various ins and outs of that story. Didn't notice it's Matana, could be. I mean, the Gemara is actually calling it Timnos, but okay, maybe Loshen Matnas could be. I don't know. Yeah. Okay, so let's analyze some details of that story of Yehuda and Tamar. The Pasuk says that when she hears that Yehuda is going to Timnas and she wants to meet him on the way, so the Pasuk says, Vateshev bePesach Einayim. She sat at Pesach Einayim. Now, if you were going to say in the most basic chat level, what would it mean? It's a place called Pesach Einayim. What would it mean at the entrance of a place called Einayim? But the Gemara gives a different understanding. For one thing, we don't find any place else in Tanakh a place called Pesach Einayim. So what would be the point of mentioning it if we can't identify it based on reference to any other pasuk? So Omer of Alexandroi, Melamed Shehoch of Yoshval of Pischa Shal Avram Avinu, Tamar went and sat by the entrance where Avram Avinu's tent had formerly been, Mokom Shekol Einayim Metzapis L'roisa. This is the place, Pesach, the entrance, Einayim, where all the eyes look forward to seeing it. People would regularly go there, and they would benefit from Avram's famous Achnosas Orchim. So therefore, so it was a famous landmark, and even now, even though this is long after Avram is gone, nevertheless, it still was a place that Tamar could use as a landmark, and she's going to go there and sit there and expect to meet Yehuda over there.
brothers and kingdoms. Right?
Well, we don't, but we find he lives in the land of the Plishtim, and we find he moves. First of all, this is on the road to Timnas. This is not in Timnas itself. He's on the road to Timnas, so he's there. But we do find Abraham lived in the Eretz Plishtim from Yom Rabim, now she says 26 years. So during that time, there was at some point where his tent was over there. Maharshal actually brings from the Mizrahi on the Pasuk that says we're not talking about the place where Abraham's tent had been, but rather we're talking about Moris HaMachpelah. Now Abraham is buried there in Kol HaNayim, at Tzafes L'Rosa. Everybody looks forward to going there and davening by the Kever of the Tzaddik. Maharshal doesn't like that explanation because our sugya doesn't seem to imply that, but other Mephoshim say, listen, you know what, in a way it does fit better. If you say it was Abraham's tent, the fact this is almost 100 years after Abraham passed away, how is it still a landmark? Mashenkin, you say it's Moris HaMachpelah, well then very well, it was a landmark from then until today, so therefore it makes more sense that you would have sat there. So it would mean, in other words, that he's coming from some other part of Eretz Yisrael to Timnasa. Timnasa would be in the land of the Plishtim, so you're talking in western Eretz Yisrael. So fine, he's going from someplace in the area of Hebron. The whole family lived in the area of Hebron, after all, so he could very well be going from there all the way to Timnasa, and she would sit in Hebron to see him. So that's one explanation. Rabbi Yochanan, or Rabbi Hanan, Omar says, no, Mokum Husha Shemar Enayim. It means there was a place called Enayim, V'chein Hu Omer, as you find a pasuk in Yeshua listing the cities of Shevet Yehuda, Tapuach V'ha Enam. There's a city called Tapuach, there's a city called Enam. So therefore, Pesach Enayim would mean the entrance of Enayim, the entrance of that place, otherwise known as Enam. Mephoshim on the pasuk say that Enam in the simple meaning over there might be in the spring of the city of Tapuach, but here the Gemara, at least according to this Man D'Omer, is saying that's an actual name of a city. Okay. Another opinion. Even Yaakov actually brings an interesting point. It may not mean the specific place where Avraham's tent was. Pesach Einayim could actually refer to the entrance of Eretz Yisrael. The whole board, all of Eretz Yisrael, can be considered Avraham's place, and the entrance from where you go, from the land of the Plishtim, to go into Eretz Yisrael proper would be Eretz Yisrael. Plishtim is technically part of Eretz Yisrael, but fine, you mean the part that was occupied by the Plishtim versus the part that later on was occupied by the Jewish people can be called Pesach Einayim. So therefore, so she's sitting there by that crossroads where you're going from the area controlled by the Plishtim to the area that's out of their control. Reb Shmuel ben Nachmani Omar, Reb Shmuel ben Nachmani gives a different explanation of what it means that she was sitting in Pesach Einayim. She nosna Einayim l'dvareha means that when Yehuda came to meet her. And he asks her a number of questions, which we can deduce from what happened over there. Then she could give good reasons and explanations of why she is in fact mutter to him. Namely, Shatova, when he asks her to have relations with him, Omala, he asks her, Shama Nochrisat, are you a goita? Omala Giyodasani, and she answers, I'm a Giyodas, meaning, as Rashi says, I'm not an Ovid Avodazara. Now there's quite a lot of discussion what it means this is before Matan Torah, how is there a concept of Geirus anyway. We talked about the other day, there's a drosha from there's a sefer of droshas from the Mishnah Melech called Parshas Drochim. His first drosha is a long, long discussion and exploration of throughout Shas all the different places where we talk about what was the status of the Jewish people before Matan Torah. Were they considered Bnei Noach? Were they considered already Bnei Yisrael? This has relevance to various areas in Halacha. We touched about in connection with Yehuda, with what Yehuda and Reuven did respectively as far as the things that they did that seemingly were wrong. He talks about that was part of the machlokas between Yosef and the brothers. About whether when they're eating, when Yosef accuses them of eating Eivim and Achai, for example, or they're eating from meat, where it's still moving after it was still moving convulsively after it was shechted, such a thing is allowed for Bnei Yisrael, also for Bnei Noach. So Yosef holds they're still considered Bnei Noach, they hold we're already considered Bnei Yisrael. And he goes in a huge Arichus over there and deals with many different Gemaras and Medrashim and explains them Kedavkei. So in that connection, he brings this Gemara as well. And one point is, we see from this Gemara, apparently already at that time, there was a difference between Jews versus Goyim. Goyim would be defined as those who are worshipping Avodah Zarah. A Geirus, like she's saying over here, is somebody who does not worship Avodah Zarah. So there may not have been a formal process of Geirus, but nevertheless there is something like that.
Avraham Megayis,
so there was that idea. There's an idea that's brought, I think, from the Brisker Rav that says that really you have, there's a difference. There's two stages of Geirus, really. The Rebbe talks about it in some circles as well, based on that. That you have, there's the stage where the person goes away from the Tumah of the Goyim, and there's another part where he gets the special Kedusha of the Jewish people. So before Matan Torah, he may not have had that second stage. Yet all of us became Geirim by Matan Torah. That's why we learn the halachas of the process process of Gerus. We learn from what the Jewish people did before Matan Torah, but nevertheless, they at least had the first stage over there. In that sense, she can say that I'm considered a Gerus. What? So they went away from that, but yeah. He asks, Shema Ashes Ish at, or you may be an Ashes Ish, are you married? Omrullah, she says, no, Pnuyani, I'm unmarried. He asks, Shema Kibal Vich Avich Kedushin, did your father maybe accept Kedushin on your behalf? Omrullah, she answers, Yisaymani. No, I was a Yosim, I was married, but I was married off by my mother or my brothers, and therefore it wasn't considered a valid marriage in Halacha, because that whole concept that a mother or brothers can marry off a Yisaym exists only Dirabonan, Midaraisa, there's no such marriage over there. In fact, Rashi uses that to explain that would be why. You think about it, at the end of the day, isn't she Yehuda's daughter-in-law? Wouldn't she be also to him on those grounds, at least according to the dinim of Bnei Yisrael? But the answer is, since she was married off to Er and then to Onan, to begin with, the ones who arranged her marriage were her mother or her brothers, then therefore the marriage was never really chal in the first place, and therefore la halacha, she's not considered to be Yehuda's daughter-in-law. She can do miyun technically, yeah, that's the whole concept of marriage like at that age, done by that, exists only Dirabbanan, and therefore she has the option of miyun, yeah. Rashi incidentally means, in other words, when the Gemara mentions in various places that she was the daughter of Shem, it can't mean literally, because Shem had passed away 60 odd years earlier than the story. The story happened sometime after Yosef was sold. Meanwhile, shame that Yosef was sold when Yaakov was over 100 years old. Meanwhile, shame had passed away when Yaakov was 50. So when we say bitter shall shame, so Rashi says our Gemara would have to disagree and say she's not literally the daughter of shame, because she couldn't have been a Ktana when she was married. She would have already been in her 60s, if not older. Some Mephoshim say that five bitish or shame doesn't necessarily have to mean literally the daughter of shame. It means a descendant of shame. She could have been a daughter of one of shame's sons or something.
Explain why she is a Gerus.
That works fine, yeah. And he asks her another thing, Shema Tmeyat, or you maybe Tomei, are you Nida Omele Tahurani? And she says, no, I'm Tahur. So in other words, everything that he thinks there might be some impediment to them having relations, then she tells him there's no problem. In that sense, we're saying that Shenosna Inayim Ledvara, how she had a good reason, a good enlightening reason, why there's no problem. Marshall goes through some more details over here. Ultimately, you have the question, even without all of, first of all, Marshall points out that even if you say, for we talked about before in connection with Shimshon, that the whole concept that for a Jewish man to have relations with a Goita was not necessarily also yet even Minat Torah, is strictly speaking something that was only asked later on by the Beis Din Shel Hashmonaim over 1,000 years later. Nevertheless, we can say Yehuda was choshish for it. But now you have the big question, what about the fact that she's a Zoyna? Where does he have a heter to have relations with her in the first place? So Marsha brings from the Mizrahi on the Pasuk that says that maybe he did Kiddushin, but no, Marsha says it doesn't really seem to fit well with Sukkim to say that there was any Kiddushin over there. Rather, the vote is, the Rambam explains at the beginning of Hilchos Issues, before the Torah was given, it was perfectly allowed to do what Yehuda and Toma are doing over there. A man and woman meet on the street, and they decide we're going to have relations, and they go into a private place, and they do that, and that's that. And only after Matan Torah do you have that you can't do, that you're not allowed to be boil without Kiddushin. Well, very well then, so in that case, what he's doing is Bechlal not Osir at this time. In fact, you also have Medrash anyway, says that even if so, it still is a gnai for Yehuda to do such a thing, which is why later on he was embarrassed and tried to cover it up, etc. So the Medrash actually says that when Yehuda passed by, he had no intentions of doing anything with her, but a Malach like forces him into it and tells him, you have to do this, this is important, the whole future of the Jewish people depends on it. Basically. Well, yeah, but, yeah. Okay. Marshall also explains as far another point as well. When he asks her, Shema Kibbol B'chavich Kiddushin, and she's answering that, no, it wasn't my father, it was my mother or brothers, and Rashi is using that to say, therefore, I'm not your daughter-in-law, Marshall says, wait a minute, the whole point is Yehuda didn't know that she's Tamar in the first place. He thought she's some random woman. So what would be the point of the question and the answer? Rather, Marshall explains, the question is, maybe when you were a Ketana, your father accepted Kedushin on your behalf, and you don't even know about it. So you could be an Eshes Ish without even knowing about it. So she tells him no. When she says, Yisoyma Ani, she means that my father passed away before I was even born. like we find by Esther and by Abiah, that their fathers passed away before they were even born. So therefore, there's no possibility that my father accepted Kedushin on my behalf. And therefore, Maharshal says, then it could actually work to say that she's actually the daughter of Shem. Because she wouldn't mean, like Rashi says, when I was Niskadish to Aaron, to Onan, I was still a Ktana. Because, yeah, then it wouldn't work chronologically. But rather, she means there's no possibility that my father was ever Mekadish me because he died before I was born 60-odd years ago. So therefore, so the result was they ended up having relations and everything developed from there. Having mentioned Pesach Einayim, having mentioned one point, we said that the door of Avraham Avinu. So now the Gemara digresses a minute from the story of Yehuda and Tamar to talk about Avraham Avinu's Achnosas Orchim. The pasuk says Vayita Eshel Be'er Sheva, that Avraham planted an Eshel in Be'er Sheva. Now the simple meaning of Eshel Mefoshim on the some Mefoshim on the pasuk explains is just like a very large tree that was used as a landmark. You find there's a different pasuk at the end of at the end of Shmuel Aleph that mentions an Eshel tree. So the Pashtus is a large kind of tree that could be used as a landmark. But then in that case, what's the big deal about it? So he planted a landmark. So therefore, the Gemara wants to find another meaning in it.
Yeah,
it was bearing
the trophy, isn't
it? That's something else. That's Tachasa Elo, actually. Elo is a different type of tree, yeah. So Amar Shlokish, Milamed Shalasa Pardis, Venotavai Kominim Megodim, this teaches us that Avraham planted an orchard and then planted in it fruit trees with all kinds of delicious fruits in it. So this way, passers-by would be able to have Hanah from it. Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemia, and then Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemia further argue in that. One agrees with Rish Lakish that it was an orchard. The other one says it was a punduk. It was an inn where people could stay overnight. In which case, Rashi points out that, so if you say it was an orchard, then fine. In other words, the word Eshel, some of the Mefarshim explain that Eshel does not necessarily have to mean a specific type of tree. It can actually mean, it can be a generic word for tree. You actually find in the story that they have at the end of Shmuel Aleph and also in Divrei Yomim, where it mentions about where they buried Shaul's bones. In one place it says Ela, and another place it says Eshel. And if you can say Eshel was a certain type of tree, that would be a contradiction. But if you say Eshel was a generic word for tree, then you're fine. So therefore, so Rish Lakish is saying fine, it means a tree, but not Stam, a tree that would be a landmark, but rather a bunch of trees that would be for people to be able to eat the fruit and enjoy the shade. V'chadam apunduk, the other one says it means an inn, in which case, Eshel says, is Rosh HaTevis, achilosh siya levoya. He would give them to eat and drink, and he would accompany them. Later on in the Masechta, it talks about in detail about the importance of levoya, the importance of accompanying a person after he ate and drank by you. One point of them makes a point in a sikh, actually, that Amma makes a big deal about Lavoya when he talks about the mitzvah of Achnosas Orchim, that Amma makes a big deal about how Lavoya is more important than anything else, based on the Gemara later, and the Rebbe develops the idea in a sikh, in one of the later Chalokim, that the idea is that, in other words, like this, you have, it's not just the chetze that you gave him food and drink, it's also the gavra that you're putting yourself into by doing Lavoya as well. A different explanation some of the Mefarshim have, I think maybe the Medrash says, I don't remember, is that Eshel stands for Achilash Siya Lina, that Lamed stands for Lina, that would give them a place to stay overnight. So the Gemara says, Bishleim Lamanda Amar Pardis, well, it's easy to understand, according to the opinion, that it was a Pardis, that it was an orchard, Heinrich Tivayita, Eshel Be'er Sheva, that's what it means, he planted an Eshel in Be'er Sheva, for Amar Shlokha Shas, a Pardis, but not to Vakomin and Megodim, so fine, the word Vayita fits very well. But if you say that it means an inn, my vayita, why are you using the word to plant in connection with an inn? You should say he built or something. And the answer is not a problem. You find another pasuk that uses it in the same vein. Kedichtiv, vayita talks about one of the kings who are going to be fighting one against one another before Mashiach comes, whether it's Mechamas Gog or Magog, whether whatever it is exactly. The pasuk has the expression, vayita ohalei apadnei, he will plant his palatial tents, bein yamim lahar tzvi kodesh, between the sea and the holy beloved mountains of Eretz Yisrael. So in other words, we see that the word vayita can be used of pitching tents. So therefore, so the same way over here would mean that Avraham pitched a tent which served as an inn for the guests. Maharshal points out also the Medrash says that Eshel is also related to the word Sha'al, that it means if whatever a person asks for, whether a person asks for bread or meat or what have you, then Avraham has it available over there, in which case Eshel and Sha'al, it's the same letter, is switched around. The Maharal makes a point. He says that the machloikas over here, whether it was, first of all, some Mephoshim say it could be, it was both. You know, it could have been an inn as well as an orchard. They don't necessarily have to be arguing. But the Maharal makes a point that a deeper idea behind it is the orchard of trees represents, in other words, that Avraham is like the first planting of a lakos in the world. Whereas the Pundek would represent more that Avraham is making a permanent binyan in the world, like, and therefore the two opinions would reflect that, what's Avraham's main contribution in the world. The pasuk continues, Vayikra Shom B'Shem Hashem Kel Olam, he called there in the name of Hashem, the God of the world. Don't read Vayikra that I've called out, because for one thing, why would it have to stress that Dafka over there he called out? The Rif points out over here, there's many all over Eretz Yisrael, wherever Abraham went is Vayikra Shom. So why would it have to stress that Dafka over here? So Ela Vayakri, but rather it means that Avraham made everybody else call in the name of Hashem. Exactly that. Malamet Shehikri, Avraham, Shemo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Befer Kol Oyvei V'Shov. Avraham caused that all passers-by are now saying and expressing and calling out the name of Hashem. Ketzad, how would he do that? And Marisha also points out part of the question is also what would be why so specially would Avraham be calling out the name of Hashem davka in a pundak or a paradis? So if we say by Yakri, it means that he used the paradis or the pundak to get them to call out on Hashem's name. So Ketzad, la'achasha ochol v'shosu, after people would eat and drink, omdu l'vorcho, they would stand up and they'd want to bless Avraham and thank him for giving them food. Omalahem, and Avraham would tell them, achim yishal v'yachaltem, you think you ate from my food? Mishel keilo l'machaltem, you ate from what belongs to Hashem, who's the God of the world. Hodo v'shabchu v'vorcho, thank and praise and bless the mishom v'hoya olam, Hashem who spoke and the world came into being. Tosfos Shanz, printed in the Gemara, brings over here the famous thing from the Medrash, that not everybody was receptive to that. Sometimes you'd have people saying, what Hashem, who Hashem, you gave us food, we want to thank you. So Avraham would tell them, you know, in that case, we got a bill over here to settle, you know, it's expensive to have food in the desert, and he'd start charging them a very high price. And then they'd say, you know what, maybe we are better off thanking Hashem. And then, so one way or the other, he'd get them to do that. Mephoshim asked the question in that case, what good does that do? So they're saying insincerely, just because they want to get out of paying a large restaurant bill. That's bringing them close to the Eveshter. So there's a famous sitter where the Rebbe talks about that what it is such people. In other words, basically what Avraham is doing with that is breaking the clipper of theirs, and therefore making that now their real essential, you know, this is after, the Rebbe makes the point, this is after the Mabel, even the Goyim, even all the Bnei Noyah have the ability to recognize that there's an Eveshter in the world, and therefore, for some people, you have to go in a way of bitush, you have to break through that clipper in order to reveal that innate ability of theirs, and this is what Avraham was accomplishing with these people who don't want to do it.
Usually, when I show Avraham's Tavudah, they use that Kedah as an example, right?
Right. So actually, there's a maimer from the Friedrich Rebbe, the maimer Laman Das, Sofer Tzadik, where the Friedrich Rebbe makes just that point. Here we have Avraham is always personifying Midas HaChesed, but yeah, here we see that Avraham's Chesed is not just a mindless Chesed, give, give, give. There's a sensible thing in it where Gvura is necessary in order to make the Chesed be a true Chesed, then Avraham is going to use that, yeah.
That's an example of Avraham's
Chesed. That's what I'm saying. So in that maimer, the Friedrich Rebbe brings exactly that example, yeah. In that connection that Rebbe also brings, by the way, you have in that Sicha, B'Sicha Dvarim, that Rebbe brings that famous story with Rebbe Elazar Rebbe Shimon and the Gemara in Tainis, where he sees an ugly person, and the guy says, go tell the craftsman that made me, and the Rebbe makes the same point, that Rebbe Elazar Rebbe Shimon sees the guy, he seems to be Mechur, not only on the outside, but on the inside too, and therefore he figures he needs to do this kind of bitush in order to force him to recognize the Eveshter. Elamai, the guy recognized it so quickly, that Rebbe Elazar realized that he'd been too hasty with it, and he didn't have to use that extreme measure in the first place. Onward, getting back to Yehuda and Tamar, the pasuk says, "Vayir'eha Yehuda." So Yehuda saw this woman sitting over there, "Vayachshavehel Zoyna," and he thought that she was a Zoyna, "ki chissa paneha," because she covered her face. Now, what does one have to do with the other? Mishum to kiss the paneh v'yachshavel a zoyna. What does that mean? Because she covered her face, therefore she thought she was a zoyna. On the contrary, a zoyna would uncover her face. And also, Yom Yaakov points out, at the very least, it should say, he saw her, that she had covered her face, and she thought she was a Zoyna. Some of us should say that, yeah, maybe it means that Zoynas in those times would wear like some kind of veil or something, but still, then it should put that first, and because he saw that she was sitting like that, therefore he thinks, yeah. But yeah, on the face of it, though, she's not going to cover her face if she's acting as one, so what does that mean? Amar Rabbi Elazar, so Rabbi Elazar doesn't mean that now she's covering her face. She kissed the panah b'beis chamiha, means when she was in her father-in-law's house before, when she was married to Erev, and then to Oinon, she would keep her face covered. So now, therefore, when, so now, therefore, Yehuda had never seen her, therefore, now when he sees her face, he doesn't recognize her. Or there's a parenthetical note in Rashi, which actually comes from Agoy Sabach, which is another way of looking at it is that since Yehuda knew, he knew what Tama was like. He knew that she was always sneistic in his house. Now when he sees a woman sitting over there, you know, I wonder, does this maybe look like Tama? Nah, can't be. I know that Tama never uncovered her face. So Marsha says something similar as well, that because she had previously covered her face, now when he sees her sitting over there with her face uncovered, like a prutza, he didn't think that it was her. The Omer of Shmuel, and what does that teach us? The Omer of Shmuel Marachmeni, Omer of Yonason, Kol Kala Shetsnua Beveis Chamira, a Kala, daughter-in-law, who's sneistic in her father-in-law's house, Zoycha V'yotzen Mena Melochim Neviim. She will have the schus that kings and Neviim will descend from her. Now, not always, and Ben Yoyada points out, doesn't always mean literally. I mean, listen, you know, you have lots of Jewish women in history who were sneistic, and not all of them have Melochim and Neviim come from them. And listen, there's only so many people that it can come from. It means that she's on the level where Melochim and Neviim could come from her. If it doesn't come out, and if it doesn't come out the Gashmias, then it'll be Beruchnias. Menola, me Tomer, and we see that from the story of Tomer. Neviim, where do we see that Neviim descended from her? Dichtiv Chazon Yishayo ben Omerz. The Nevuah, the vision of Yishayo ben Omerz. Now, the Gemara tells us in Megillah, a general rule, that whenever it says a Novi's name with his father's name, means that his father was a Novi as well. Therefore, we see that not only Yishayo was a Novi, but so was Omerz. And who were they? What family were they from? We have this as a Masurda from our ancestors that's in our hands. Omotz va'amatzia achim havu, that Omotz, the father of Yishaya, and Amatzia, who was one of the kings of Yehuda, were brothers. In fact, you have in Dirayom, it tells a story where Amatzia at one point fought against Edom and won a great victory, and then he made a serious mistake and brought their jetchkas and started worshipping them, and the Pasuk says a Novi came to him and told him off for that. Rashi brings over there that Novi is none other than Omotz, his own brother. So we see that Omotz is descended. So we see that Omotz and his son Yeshaya are descended from the family of the kings. Therefore, they're descended from Tamar. By the way, that might explain. You know, you ever learn Sefer Yeshaya, and you should. By the way, it's a fascinating and beautiful Sefer. There's a lot of parts of it where the language is very high flown and sometimes a bit hard to understand. I guess you could say he's from the royal family. He's used to speaking in a very high toned kind of language like that. Anyway, so you see that Neviim descended from Tamar, and you see that the king is obviously because the whole mouth is based on David. So you see, because that she has that schus, because she was sneistic back in Yehuda's house. Why, doctor, does she have this schus from Melochim? And Neviim, Ben Yehoyada gives one reason for it, because both the Melochim and Neviim cover and protect the Jewish people, each in their own way. One by protecting them, by getting them to do tshuva from their Averis. The other one protect them against their Gashmiistic enemies, so therefore she who protects, who covers her face, is appropriate that such things should come from her. Now, continuing with Tamar, so you have the part of the story over there where Yehuda is informed that she's pregnant and there seems to be znus involved, and Yehuda and his beis din sit together and decide that she should be burnt. So the pasuk says, he mutzeis, as she was being taken out to be burnt, v'hi sholchah chamir, then she sent a message to her father-in-law saying that I have these three things and recognize whose they are. So the question is, what's the lashon mutzeis? He mitoitseis mi boilei. Shouldn't the pasuk say he mitoitseis, which would mean meloshin yitzia, that she's being taken out? Instead, he mutseis almost sounds like meloshin mitzia. So what does that mean? Baral actually says that the word mitoitseis wouldn't necessarily be proper loshin kodesh, but in other words, why is the pasuk mutseis? He says is loshin hoive, like she's being taken out. But this is something that happened in the past. It should say he hutseis, which would clearly be loshin ovar. Why mutseis? So the answer is it is meloshin mitzia. Amar Rabbi Elazar, la'acha shenimtzu simoneha, after her simonim were found, you have the three things that Yehuda had given her as a pledge, chaysamcho, matcho, upsilacha, then after those were found, bas samachmem v'richakon, the samachmem, Esav's malach, came and took them away. Rashi points, first of all, he's the star of Edom, and Rashi points out he wants that she should be burned, and now, it's like this, she's already pregnant with Peretz and Zerach, Peretz being the ancestor of David HaMelech. If she ends up getting burned, then that whole family will never come into existence, and in particular, David fought against Edom and killed many of them. We have in the caption of Kapitel Samach of Tillim, so says, Saram Na'arayim, Saram Tzoyva, Yoshev Yoyev, Yachas Edom, Begay Melech Hashanim, Asa'olach, so therefore, so the Malach, Samach Mem, which is the Malach of Esav, did not want that she should survive this whole thing. So he wanted, so therefore he took away the simonim and hid them. But Gavriel the caravan. But then Gavriel came and brought them back close, and therefore the Pasuk is saying, he mutzeis, Meloshin Metzia, as in Hashem caused, Hashem sent the Malach to find these things and restore her to them, so that now she could tell Yehuda, recognize who these things belong to. Marsha points out, Gavriel, first of all, is a Malach having to do with burning, and all that we find in many places in Shas, that he's the Malach of fire. He's the one, when Avraham Avinu was in the Kibshan Eish, he offered to save Avraham, and Hashem says, I'll do it myself. When it comes to Hanani, Mishael, Vazariah, he saves them. So he's a Malach of fire, and also, he's Muhammad Schus on the Jewish people, as we find in other relevant Gemaras as well. So therefore, he's particularly the one to try to work to save Tamar. So the Hainu Dichtiv, thus you have generations later, Tomer's descendant, David, says in a Kapitel Tillim, he starts off Lamnatseach al Yonas Elim Rechoikim le David Michtam. Lamnatseach for the conductor, al Yonas Elim Rechoikim, about the mute dove that's far away. L'David, Michtam, and the Gemara is going to, a simple meaning of Michtam is a special, beautiful capital. Meloshin, Meforshim say on the Pasuk, it's Meloshin Kesem Paz, like a beautiful ornament of gold, or a beautiful ornamental capital to them. But the Gemara is going to explain in a second another meaning of Michtam that it refers to David HaMelech. So in other words, teaching the Pasuk, according to the Drasha, that he's singing a capital about the dove representing Tamar, who is named after the Jewish people collectively, are often compared to a dove. Elam, that's mute, where she's not, so that Marsha explains, she's not openly saying that I'm pregnant by you. She's only hinting to it, like a mute person gestures, Rechoikim, far away, because her simonim were far away, until Gabriel brought them, L'David, and this was the result of that. Comes out David, Michtam, where the Gemara is going to explain that Michtam is a reference to David. So what that means, Amar Rabbi Yechanan, La'achar, Rabbi Sharshan, Israchku, Simoneha, when her simonim are far away, Nasis Kiyona Yulemes. At that point, Tamar is like a mute dove. She has no ability to say anything. She has no ability to prove that she's pregnant by Yehuda. Whereas now, when Gavriel brought the simonim back to her, then she has the ability to say, as she says in the Pasuk, Isha She'eloloi Anoshi Hora, and even then, as Marashal says, since she didn't want to embarrass him publicly, as the Gemara is going to say soon, that a person should better fall into a Kivshana Eish, rather than embarrass somebody in public, so she didn't say openly, these are yours, but rather she said, Hakim, no, please recognize, and then, and tell the truth. So when the Pasuk says, L'David Michtam, when the Pasuk says, in the simple meaning of the Pasuk, by the way, it's talking about that David composed this capital, as the Pasuk says, Be'achoizos, they plished him begas, when the plished arrested him in gas, and they were threatening to kill him because he had killed Goliath. So Ian Yaakov explains, in other words, the connection is that David was saved. Zelo Maseh also on a kid. Now he had the power of Kedusha on his side. So the same way over here, he's saying that the same way as Tamar all those years ago had the Hashem help that she had in her schus that Hashem saved her. The same way Hashem should save me now. The Rif makes a point also that David is saying basically the same way as you saved her then, in order that Malchus based David should be established. So now please save me for the same reason, because I'm in danger. And while David Michtam, what does the word Michtam mean? She yotzim and David she moch the tom lakol. From her descended David, who is moch, who is humble and tom and perfect to everybody. He was humble relative to everybody. Davaracham Michtam shows him a kosei tama. Another meaning is that his wound was perfect. The place of the milah, where usually there would be a wound, was perfect, meaning that he was born gemalot. Marsha points out, you have the famous Gemara where he's in the bathhouse and he says, I'm naked of mitzvahs, and then he realizes, but I have the bris milah, and he's happy about that, and composes, well, I'm not saying a shminis for it, so fine, not that he needed a milah, but at least he's saying that I'm not an oral, that itself is a milah. There's a famous Lomdash idea that I've brought in Sikhas sometimes, that when it comes to milah, it's a pu'ulanim shechas, it's not just a one-time thing, it's done when a baby is 8 days old, it's an ongoing thing throughout his lifetime, that he has the status of a gemalot person, and this is what David is thankful for. Dover Acha, another explanation. Nichta means Kevshem Shebekatnusa, Hikdin Atzma, it's a Mishik Godom Imenu. Just like when David was younger, before he became king, he would humble himself by anybody greater than him and go to learn Torah, Kakbig Dulase. The same thing, even when David was great, when he was a king, Hikdin Atzma, it's a Mishik Godom Imenu. Lomad Torah, he would do the same thing when he was greater, he would humble himself. Again, Nichtam, Meloshin Moch, and Tom, that he would humble himself to learn Torah Sashem Tzmima from whoever is available. Yom Yom Mashiach Gula, Vav Ir. So Eretz Yisrael, the complete, perfect Eretz Yisrael, is the land of the 10 nations that are mentioned by the Bris Vein Absarim. And then what's going to happen when Mashiach comes? We will in fact have the Keni Knesset V'Kadmoni. We'll get them B'Darkei Noam or B'Darkei Shalom. There won't be any war because, as the Rambam says, there won't be any famine or war. Instead, the Umas HaOlam will give them over to the Jewish people free willingly. Okay, continuing with Halachas of Rosh Chodesh, which is also Azman Grama, because now in Shlosha Parakim we're learning about Kiddush HaChodesh. So it's a mitzvah to have an extra big soda on Rosh Chodesh. If it's Shabbos, where anyway you're having a big soda, then make one extra dish that you wouldn't make on a regular Shabbos, and that way you're honoring Rosh Chodesh with that. Famous thing that's brought, there are two simonim in Shulchan Aruch that are each one line. One is that Yisadar Shulchanim Mitzvah Shabbos, and the other one is that a person should have a Suda on Rosh Chodesh, and that underscores the importance of those things, that each of them deserves an entire simon in Shulchan Aruch just for that one line.